Good morning. I'd like to introduce our guest speaker today, Inryu Bobby Ponce-Barger. She is the guiding teacher at All Beings Sangha in Washington, D.C., and is in the Suzuki Roshi lineage. And I met Inryu at a Soto Zen Buddhist Association conference. And she also came to a protest I was at that I talked about a while back at Fort Sill in Oklahoma, protest against the detention of migrant children. And Inryu is very, very aware of interconnections regarding climate and social justice and things like that. She's also a beekeeper. We were having a dinner outside last night, Kathy and Inryu and me, and a little bee came and landed on her forearm and just kind of relaxed there. And I thought, well, that's a good sign. That was nice. So, Inryu, I'm so glad you're here. Oh, and she's giving two talks today. You're welcome to stay for both.
Thank you, Dunnan. So just curious, as I look around the room, are there people here for the first time? Anyone? Yeah? Great. Are there people who are somewhat new to Buddhism, to Zen practice? Okay, thank you. That's very helpful. So I titled my talk this morning, The Great Way of the Buddhas, which is kind of a big subject. So I'll get into it in a little while, but sometimes it's helpful to kind of establish who's talking to you for me to figure that out. So I, of course, need to extend my gratitude to my Zen teacher, Dairyu Michael Wanger. He is the a guiding teacher for a temple called Dragon's Leap Temple in San Francisco, California. But he was a big presence and supporter of the San Francisco Zen Center for about 35 years before he founded his own temple, Dragon's Leap. And he, Dairyu, speaks of the Katagiri lineage and the people here in Minnesota with such fondness. And so my meeting of these Katagiri lineage practitioners of the Way of Zen at the September 2018 Soto Zen Buddhist Conference was like opening a chapter in my understanding of my teacher's life. And I found these people, your people, really wonderful. In their caring for the Dharma and our world. And so your co-guiding teacher, Dōnen, and I became acquainted, and I had the good fortune of him suggesting that we provide some peer support to each other. So we've gotten to know each other over the past year, helping each other in our roles to lead Sangha. And just a few days ago, I was relatively nearby, down in Milwaukee, attending a Suzuki Roshi Branching Streams conference. So this is where sanghas who have a lineage holder leading them that can directly trace from Suzuki Roshi and their lineage, we come together. And I was on the program committee for the conference, and the theme was on social justice. So specifically restorative justice, and environmental justice and climate crisis. So being only a five-hour drive away, I thought I'd come here afterwards to visit. So thank you for allowing me to be in your presence and offer this talk. So my full Buddhist name is Shinchi Inryu, Body Wisdom, Hidden Dragon. This is the Dharma name that was given to me by Dairyu, my teacher. Dai means great, so he's Great Dragon. And this was in 2005 at the Tassajara Zen Mountain Center in the Los Padres National Forest in California. And that's when I received a blue rakusu, like some of the people here in the room are wearing. a very heartfelt symbol and process of accepting and embracing the precepts of Buddhism, how to conduct our lives in the world. And then in 2013, with five other people, I received priest ordination at San Francisco Zen Center, or priest robes. And then 2 years ago, in 2017, I received full transmission to wear the brown robe and to teach from a spot like this sometimes. So I'm originally from Southern California, but I've lived in the Washington, D.C. metro area since 1985. And I currently reside in a neighborhood called Adams Morgan with my husband, Kurt, my dog, Henri, four rescue cats, I'll name them, Francis, Lucky Liberty, Mr. Chill, and little girl. I helped to start or found our Sangha in Washington, D.C. in 2004, and we first started meeting in what had been my yoga studio. And we regularly meet for Zazen and intensive sesshins, workshops. We have guest speakers like you have. I also have a history of working in the fields of emergency services and homeless and housing services. So some of you may know, some of you are new to practice or Buddhism, that Katagiri, the founder of this temple, and Suzuki Roshi, the founder of my lineage in the San Francisco Zen Center, are in the historical teaching lineage of a man named Dogen. He was a 13th century Japanese man who practiced both in Japan and in China. And he practiced with men and women, not exclusively in a male monastery. So I'd like to touch on a topic that Ehe Dogen talked about called the Great Way of the Buddhas. And one of the great things about Dogen is that he didn't stay secluded away in a monastery or a hermit's hut all his life. He was engaged in the society of his time. His teachings were offered not just to the monastic community that he led, but also to benefit lay followers. And this included his patron, who was the governor of Izumi province. So like Dogen's audience, you in this room are varied in your knowledge and experience. If you are here at this Zen Center this morning, you're likely seeking, even unconsciously, a sort of refuge. All of us in some way are seeking and perhaps finding refuge in something. Something that helps us make sense of our place, our purpose, our direction. We in Buddhism call this ongoing life activity our practice. Some of you take refuge in the art of medicine. Some in the practice of scientific inquiry. Some people take refuge in baseball. Perhaps you have other non-Buddhist traditional religious practices that support your well-being and that you take refuge in. So the Buddhist practice that Ehe Dogen carries forward into today likely does not need to conflict with your own existing practices. And it may support and deepen them. So this was titled The Way of the Buddhas. But I find it helpful to offer just a little information, especially for new people, about the Buddha. So there have been many wise, awakened, enlightened humans over the millennia. But the person most of us know about as the historical Buddha was a person raised in a very affluent Indian clan somewhere around 500 400-500 BCE. And the name of his clan was Shakyamuni. And he was educated and nurtured and protected by his parents until he was a young man. And then he was shocked to see with his own eyes humans that had died. People who were diseased and dying. And his response was to study the yoga of his time, the methods of that day, to understand and master the practices of the great teachers he could find in that era. And unsatisfied with that, he meditated until he himself awakened to a truth that made sense to him. Very briefly, and this is just my very crib notes explanation, what made sense to him was, or what he saw, was that everyone suffers. That aversion and attraction are the root of the suffering. That by removing the aversion and attraction, the suffering would cease. And the way to remove the aversion and attraction was to follow the Eightfold Path. So those in very brief are right views, intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. So right views. What is really happening? Intention. What's behind our aim? Speech. Is the energy that's coming out of my mouth helpful? Action. Are our actions beneficial? Livelihood. Am I supporting my life in a method in accord with my values? Effort. Am I giving the task before me the energy and focus it really needs? Mindfulness. Am I aware of my body in all its depth? And my mind in all its breadth? Concentration. Do I have the skill to stick with it? So I find the way of the bow, like the bow and arrow, a nice image to think about this. So imagine in my left hand I have the bow, in my right hand I have the arrow. And I pull the arrow back, and I take aim, and I let go, and I miss the mark. When I take aim again, when I pull the next arrow, what more can I bring to this to meet my aim? I can't be thinking about anything other than what I'm doing. I can't be looking at anything other than where I'm aiming. My whole body, my whole mind needs to be right there in order to meet that moment. So I miss the mark and I try again. So is it in the way of medicine, in the way of learning. Have to keep going. In Soto Zen, we do a lot of silent meditation. We believe that if you comport yourself then with the skills, in addition, of right views, intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration, the result will be a balance of the practitioner, you, holding in one hand wisdom and in the other hand compassion. The result of having that balance is that our Buddha nature then is revealed. Dogen Zenji says, when we thoroughly explore what the great way of the Buddhas is, we find it is liberation from delusion and letting our true self manifest to the full. Until recently, I was teaching a meditation class in the DC jail. And at the end of the class, the men and I would stand up in a circle. And to conclude the class, we'd raise one hand. And we'd hold in that hand, we'd say, wisdom. And then we'd lift up the second hand, and we'd say, compassion. And when they're brought together, peace. But what is peace? What is contentment? What is wisdom? What is compassion? A simple question can be what we call a koan. A simple question is, in fact, often very complex. Sometimes a complex question can be narrowed down to something simple. So, some of you may know about classic Zen koans. Some of them are meant to be a bit mind-loosening. Kind of a turning phrase. Sometimes they're a conversation or a question. To me, it's a point of inquiry. It can create a space so that maybe my mind can open to see something already there, already present, and true and beneficial. So Dogen says, the way of the Buddhas is emancipation and realization. A couple of days ago, as I mentioned, I was at the Branching Streams Conference, and we took some really deep dives into a number of areas in which great illness is manifest in our world. Mass incarceration, environmental degradation, social justice, and the newest concerns out of climate science were our topics. It was so much to hold in our hearts. A great teacher named Kobenchino was known to have said, the more you sense the rareness and value of your world, of your life, the more you realize that how you use it, how you manifest it, is all your responsibility. We face such a big task, so naturally we sit down for a while. So Dogen Zenji, the 13th century founder of Soto Zen, really emphasizes just sitting. Shikantaza. It is very helpful. For those of us who have the affinity for it, it's essential. So a koan kind of fits the moment, particularly given the topics of the conference I was at last week and some of the things that I've been kind of holding and in discussion with people over the last few days. And so here's the koan for you. Medicine and sickness cure each other. The whole world is medicine. What is the self? This is the classic koan. My teacher, Daryu, has Parkinson's disease. And he often used this koan in my training. So it came to mind easily when I began to frame my view of the reality of the idea of sickness as opposed to health. So medicine and sickness cure each other. The whole world is medicine. What is the self? In our linear thinking, we might land on a response of the self as disease. But that would be an error. Because the self is part of the whole world. So the self must be medicine too. But then what is disease? Is disease separate and apart from the whole world? I can perhaps experience a shift that might let me see or feel or wonder if sickness and medicine are not two. And yet the reality is that they are not one either. A learned translator was visiting a monastery, and there was a guide showing him around, probably the Shika, right? The guest manager was showing him around. And he looked up over the gate above the entrance to the monastery, and he could see the kanji carved in the wood. And having the skill to translate it, he said to his guide, It says not two. Why doesn't it just say one? And the guide said, well, that wouldn't be right either. It's our funny Buddhist math. Not two, not one. What do you get? If the whole world is medicine, I wonder, is the disease medicine too? One of the awakenings that occur in Zen meditation practice and other kinds of Buddhist practice is the realization, I can awaken to the realization that the I in Inryu am not separate from you. Or the trees surrounding the Zen center. Or the bald eagle at the top of the pine tree at the end of the block. The cicadas, the birds. The eye of Inryu is changing moment by moment. It's not fixed in space and time, and everything changes. You are changing. The trees are changing. The songbirds are changing. My moment of being right now is dependent on your being right now. Here is the emancipation from the I that Dogen was talking about. There is no I without all the myriad things that have happened before, and the constellation of myriad things and beings happening right now. There isn't anything for me to cling to. And there is the liberating and wonderful discovery that I'm connected to all people. mountains, rivers, birds, insects. How could my heart not be filled with compassion for the mountain that is coal mined, or the river diverted, or the child in an ICE border facility, for a person who is in pain, for all people, including me, who have the chronic and conditioned sick of being, of eventually having sickness, old age, and death ahead of us. So here's Dogen. Also, calmly reflect upon whether this life of the present moment, as well as the various thoughts and things that coexist with this life, are a part of life or are not a part of life. There is nothing, not a single moment, not a single thought or thing that is not a part of life. There is nothing, not a single matter, not a single state of mind that is not also a part of life. For instance, life is like a time when I am aboard a boat. I gotta put these on now. While I'm on this boat, I manipulate the sails, I handle the rudder, I push the punting pole. At the same time, the boat is carrying me along, and there is no I that is outside this boat. My sailing in a boat is what makes this boat be a boat. You need to do your utmost to explore through your training what is going on at this very moment. For this very moment, there is nothing other than the world of the boat. The sky, the water, the shore, all have become this moment of the boat, which is completely different from occasions when I'm not in the boat. Thus, life is what I am making life to be, and I am what life is making me to be. While being carried on a boat, my body and mind, and their inner causes and outer conditions, are all together, a part of the way a boat functions. The whole of the great earth and the whole of the expanse of space are likewise a part of the way the boat functions. What this metaphor is saying is that life is what I is, and I is what life is. So what is life? What is our practice? I'd like to do a very brief exercise with you. So, the question is, what does your practice ask of you? Whatever your practice is. So what I'd like to do is for 1 minute for you to have a chance to verbally answer that. So how we're going to do that is you're going to be beside someone, just look at each other, and one person will ask, what does your practice ask of you? And you'll answer, if you can, in one word or a short phrase. And they'll ask the question again. Okay? So, could I use your bell? I'm going to time it it won't be very long, very brief. If you would just turn to someone. Thank you. Is everybody with someone? Okay, so let's do this all together. So I'll ring the bell. One person asks, what does your practice ask of you? And you answer. The questioner asks the question again for as many times as we can process this. Okay, here we go.
It asked me to be present.
Keep going. Keep asking the question. So I'm noticing as I'm looking around, there are a few people that didn't have a partner. So I apologize for that. But perhaps you can envision somebody asking you this question and what your response would be. And I would suggest to you that you audibly say it. Okay? So if you are not in a dyad, please still ask yourself the question and audibly say something. But those of you that are in the twos, you're going to switch roles now for 1 minute. Right. Okay? You didn't have anybody? Yeah. Okay. So here we go. Remember, the question is, what does your practice ask of you? Thank you. When I had this experience with this question recently, I discovered there were so many facets of my being that my practice asked me to engage with. Right? became aware of what a big task it is. And I hope that you discovered maybe something that you didn't know in being asked the question. Right? Sort of a koan. What does your practice ask of you? And it will be different this afternoon than it is this morning or tomorrow. Or when you're engaged in a difficult conversation. Or where your task is something that you maybe don't enjoy. Right? But it's still the same practice. We still bring the same attention, aim, awareness. Bring our precepts to it. I was at our All Beings Zen Sangha farm retreat location for Sesshin in August. It's where we do a 5-day intensive where we sit a lot of zazen and we eat in a very formal 3-bowl oryoki ritualized method. We have talks, go for a lot of walking outdoors, and we're silent most of the time. It's a real opportunity to ask myself, what's happening in my practice? What's happening in my, to sort of notice those myriad things. And we're doing kinhin a particular morning in the kitchen garden. We're walking slowly, quietly together through the kitchen garden. And I saw a swallowtail butterfly with a damaged wing. And my first response was, it felt like my heart was wounded. As I saw the marring of this beautiful creature. But in the next moment, I saw it fly as if its wings were whole and perfect. How did it do that? I saw that I had projected my very limited human knowledge into a story about that swallowtail that was in error. And I had a moment of intimacy. I saw how I was off the mark in my observation, in my awareness, in my projecting my human limited field of knowing. I learned something. So our Sangha, Ongo, this fall, is focusing on the whole world, the whole earth is my body. That's our theme. And one of the books that we're looking at is by a person who has an academic background, but also Soto Zen background. And her name is Stephanie Kanza, and she's written a number of books. But we're going to be studying this Green Buddhism book. It's a collection of essays. And actually has some valuable critiques of how perhaps it's an error to try to draw too many parallels with some Buddhist teachings with environmentalism, but there are other ways that we can see where the two branches support each other. I'm going to have to find my glasses again. These glasses are new to me. Wearing glasses is new to me, so. So this is Stephanie Kanza. Does the practice of non-dual intimacy change our behavior toward the natural world? Inevitably. Meeting the other in its suchness, the full nature of something in a given moment, opens the heart to the exquisite beauty and suffering in the world. The full radiance of a hummingbird or a swallowtail reveals not only their own miraculous lives, but the dazzling energetic force field out of which they arise. contact may also come through a sudden moment of witnessing another suffering. Once I heard a great baby horned owl fall out of its nest onto the roof of the meditation hall. The sharp screams of the parents careened overhead, penetrating the quiet stillness within. There could be no separation from the meditators on their cushions, and the one cry of alarm entered all our minds. Experiencing such intimacy and compassion, one becomes less able to consciously destroy companions in the web of life. It causes too much pain. Instead, one becomes kinder, less aggressive, more receptive in greeting others. Trees, crickets, the busy spiders filling the windows. As one removes some of the blocks to intimacy with the more than human rather than non-human world, one becomes less self-centered, less human-centered, more a participant than a ruler in the big conversation. Living in intimate relation with others, one senses the possibility of place-specific intelligence, a co-created dance of minds and mind forms evolved over time in this particular time and space, this realm. This becomes not only something to protect, but something to learn from. The people might come to find a way to live more closely with the natural world. Then perhaps we will increase the odds that the opportunities for such intimacy continue into the future. And that may sustain the lives of humans and oak trees and whales and slugs. So being in this place of intimacy, it's not easy to do all the time. We students, we practitioners, whatever our practice is, sometimes miss the mark. It isn't that we failed, it's that everything is changing. And we need to see what is happening, really happening, and refine our aim. If there are obstacles, and there probably are going to be many in our lives, we'll need to shift our position and be able to take a different position and view in order to refine our aim. In order to have a more intimate view of what's really happening. So I make mistakes all the time. You know, we have adages in Zen that are like, dig a hole, fill it up. My current favorite is, fall down 7 times, get up 8. With the climate crisis bringing even children in the streets to raise their voices, their bodies crying out for help, it's easy to drop into separation of self and others and despair that nothing will change. But Dogen reminds us that emancipation, the truth that everything changes, and realization that we all are all co-arising together, asks us to exhale, remember our bodhisattva vows to save all beings, So I love this Rumi poem. I find it very inspiring, and when I fail, it gives me heart. I'd like to share it with you. So this is Rumi. Come, come, come. Whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, ours is not a caravan of despair. Come, even if you have broken your vow 1,000 times. Come. So I'd like to finish with two lessons I really love from Shunryu Suzuki Roshi. They're very brief. So he was speaking to his students. So he's speaking to me and he's speaking to you too, right? And he said, each one of you is perfect just the way you are. And you could use a little improvement. So the other teaching he offered, he was asked by Mel Weitzman, one of his students, what is nirvana? So have people heard that phrase, nirvana? Suzuki Roshi responded, seeing one thing through to the end. So let's bring compassion in one hand and wisdom in the other and bring them together. May we and all beings have the wisdom and compassion to see whatever is before us through to the end. May we find comfort in the truth that nothing in our world has unchanging nature. May we each day discover and renew our awe and place with beings like butterflies, mountains, rivers, that are indeed more than human. May we have the courage, strength to live in accord with our precepts, to free all beings from suffering without exception. Thank you for listening.
We have time for questions.
A few.
Okay.
Would you like?
Sure. It's fine.
First, thank you. I just arrived from Brazil, and I worked there with Quiet Life Constellation. Yep. It's a very painful time. I would like to ask, how can we deal with it? Like, sometimes it's just a lot of pain that I just don't want to see the vision. But if we then work with conservation, if we just keep ourselves away, it will be even worse. But if I'm going every day seeing it, it's like just too much.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the paradox. You know, our lives feel so vast. The system's so complex. The pain very real. What we can bring to it is our practice to see that pain doesn't need to equal suffering. we can be in pain and have a clear mind and know what to do next. So taking care of ourselves as individuals so that we can manifest our full intimacy with the issue, the problem, the moment, it's really essential. As Copincino said, you know, things are so vast, so naturally we sit down for a while. So stay with your Zen practice, please. Let it help ground you and refresh you and open you to beauty. That sustains us when we can be with the trees and be in a room with other well-hearted, well-meaning people also engaged with these life practices, really. Yeah. Thank you for your work. Thank you.
It's a good follow-on to that now, actually. Just want to, maybe in this in your practice or maybe in this conference that you went to with all these heavy topics, did you talk about, you know, the desire for the relief, for change, for some relief in all these things versus, so desire versus the responsibility or ownership or even guilt or pain, those things. Because the traits have the aspiration to free all beings, and that's a big test.
Yeah. Yeah. We really didn't try to lessen the blow of the reality in educating ourselves about these immense issues and questions. But we recognized, each of us, our role in sometimes perpetuating systems of suffering. Often. And that was something we spent some good time looking at. And so if we can see it, that aspect of awareness that Zazen often allows us to have a little more of a clearer view of what's really happening, then we can take ownership and we can make the changes ourselves that are perpetuating some of the systems of oppression, the systems of, you know, mad consumerism, the systems of militarism, of racial dynamics and inequality. If we can see our own place in it and not look away, then we have the opportunity to make a shift, to learn something. That's the way Zen people kind of approach these problems. Not looking away. And sometimes all you can say is, I'm not looking away. Maybe there's nothing more you can do, but acknowledge you're not looking away. And voice that. That helps. Yeah.
One more?
Okay.
So, actually faced a lot of oppression here myself as a woman. Practice just in not look away. And practice compassion and courage, nevertheless, so I have and I do every day. I would like to know how you face the people that you encounter in homelessness and social injustice situations. How do you process your emotions and just realizing that there's all sorts of delusion and shame based language around the blaming of people in oppression?
Could you repeat the question, please?
They'd like you to repeat the question.
I'm asking how she addresses the issue of shame-based blaming language for people in oppression.
Right. I mean, sometimes I've had the opportunity to set up advisory councils for homeless programs, and that's like all different people from different levels of interaction, the clients in the homeless shelters, the government entities, the council people, the neighbors, that sort of thing. And I think my response is that we're all leaders, and we can all create the framework under which we are willing to be in conversation. So as a starting point to make sure that everybody has an equal amount of time to speak or respond or voice their concerns, breaking the hierarchy that way, breaking the patterns in that way. So thank you for your work and not looking away and addressing it. That's exactly what we have to do in every experience, in every group dynamic we're in. And to know our own tendencies. Do we have a tendency to think, well, that person's wrong and I'm right? Or I'm right and that person's wrong? Or avoid the conflict or compromise? Or spend the time to really work out and create something new, a new pattern of engagement. That's actually something we did at the conference. All of us went through an exercise to see sort of where we fell in different situations, what our immediate responses would be when conflict arose. So those are important things to know about ourselves and to see, is that the place you want to really be when a conflict arises? So, yeah. You're welcome.